Bien, je vous propose de vous asseoir. Nous allons commencer le séminaire. Switching to English, I'm very happy to welcome today Professor Klaus Zuber-Buller, who made the trip for us from Neuchâtel, where he's now a professor at the University of Neuchâtel. He was before a professor in St. Andrews, and he still spent 20% of his time there. And he's a specialist of primatology, of course, but specifically the analysis of communication and whether there is a combinatorial component to communication in non-human primates. He started with a PhD with Robert Seyfarth, who is really one of the most important researchers who studied the nature and especially the semantic content of communication in monkeys, and then continued with a postdoc in Leipzig with Michael Tomasello, and a short stay at the Institute of Advanced Studies in Berlin before St. Andrews and now Neuchâtel. But in addition, of course, to these universities, he does a lot of work in the field. The specificity of his approach is really to look at natural communication in a natural setting with a variety of species in Africa, in South America, in Asia, and showing that when you analyze these productions and these communication situations, you can find a sort of combinatorial system. So without further ado, welcome, Klaus.
Okay, so hello everyone. So it's a great pleasure and honor for me to be here. I've never given a presentation here at the Collège de France. And thank you, Stans, for inviting me here. It's wonderful. My focus in this series on animal cognition will be on non-human primates, and particularly their communicative capacities, their natural communicative capacities. And the reason we're interested in this, like many people who study animal cognition, is ultimately really to understand our own species. And as you all know, we are primates with a long shared evolutionary history with all the other primates, notably the great apes. And depending on who you listen to, we did have a common ancestor with the chimpanzees and bonobos, between sort of 6 and 10 million years ago. So if you go back in time, we and them were one species, and then only very recently split into different groups. And so this shared phylogenetic history will have left traces, not only in terms of the morphology, so we are very similar in many ways to the chimpanzees and bonobos, just in terms of our general anatomical features, but presumably also in terms of the neural structures and the cognition that these machines produce. And that's really kind of our main underlying hypothesis, that because of this relatively close ancestry, we can expect similarities. So what we're really interested in our research is the origins of communication, of particularly human language. And I want to start first with one manifestation of language, and that is speech. So as you probably know, there have been many attempts to teach non-human primates basic human communication systems. So here is one very famous case in the literature, two psychologists from the US who argued that, well, if you raise a young chimpanzee in a human cultural environment and you give him a little extra help with controlling his vocal tract, then it should be possible to teach this little fellow basic human language. And so they did use basic the methodology of speech therapy, and but as probably many of you know, these experiments failed quite miserably. So what this little chimp learned, despite a lot of effort, was a very small number of utterances that were quite difficult to understand, frankly. So here's this little chimp who's called Vicky, trying to say mama.
Mama.
OK, Okay, so the second one was the chimp, the first one the human, so I'll play it again just so you can see. Okay. Then Papa.
Who am I? Papa?
Okay, so with a little bit of, you know, goodwill, you can interpret it that way. And then the third one, cup. Okay, so maybe you've noticed a few things. So clearly the chimp understands what's required from her. She knows what she's supposed to do, and she does try quite hard to imitate these human sounds, but maybe if you listen carefully, you would have noticed that this sound production was not really based on the activity of the larynx. So it was some other source of sound production that the chimp did, and then, you know, more or less managed to imitate these signals. Well, anyway, this and other research projects got abandoned fairly quickly. People tried with gestures as well and lexigrams, etc. But by and large, this kind of approach to study the origins of language and the cognition underlying primate communication pretty much has come to an end because it didn't really produce that much anymore. So going back to this observation that the chimp was able to imitate more or less the general sound structure, but not with the larynx, has led to this hypothesis that, well, maybe what is at the core of the origins of speech is a combination of both larynx control, which we have clearly. I can sing, I can produce sounds at will whenever I want, but I can also at the same time control my whole articulatory apparatus. I can move my tongue, my lips, my mandibles in highly coordinated ways in conjunction with the larynx. And what non-human primates or great apes seem to be able to do is just to control the apparatus above the larynx. And so here is it's an anecdote, admittedly, but there are many reports from great apes who can do all kinds of amazing activities at the level of the supralaryngeal vocal tract. So for example, here is an individual who has spontaneously learned to imitate whistling sounds from an animal caretaker at a zoo. So if you just listen to this, you see that. I mean, if you remember when you were a child and trying to learn to whistle, it's not a trivial task. To practice quite hard until you get all these little maneuvers right so that you can actually produce a sound. And for that, you do need a pretty high level of motor control. So it looks like this was not the limiting factor in the origins of speech. More likely, it was the laryngeal control, voluntary control of sound production, which all primates struggle with, except for humans. Okay, but what I want to do today is not talk about the origins of speech as such, because we do know that non-human primates are limited in that domain, and there are very clear neurobiological reasons for that, into which I don't want to go into. But what I want to do more is talk about language much more broadly, and in particular the cognition that is required for the language faculty to emerge. And so it's going to be a more cognitive, psychological approach, which I think is hopefully quite fitting for this seminar series. And I want to focus on three aspects that I personally regard as essential for any kind of language ability. The first one, which has just been termed in quotes referential, refers to this capacity to somehow extract meaning from sounds. You know, so this is at the core of our communication system. We hear each other talking, and we can, just by listening to the acoustic signals, in combination with our knowledge and context, extract meaning. And so the question is, can primates do something similar or not? And I'm going to present a few studies that we and other groups have done to address this question. But that's not enough, because what happens in human language is that we don't just broadcast our thoughts and observations into the universe, but we socially address them. So we have always an audience in mind, a recipient, a target that we interact with and that we are trying to intentionally inform and communicate to. But thirdly, some people have argued, and I agree, that language is also something that is highly, highly cooperative, in that we don't just try to maneuver or manipulate our interlocutor, for example, just to get them to do this or that or move away, etc. But we also share our thoughts and knowledge with each other. So a lot of human communication is really very cooperative, in the sense that I'm trying to say stuff to you that I think that you find relevant. And if I think that you don't find this relevant, I sometimes prefer just to say nothing. So I do, in a sense, help you. I do try to interact with your worldview, what you think you find interesting. And for that, of course, I need to know something about your mind. I do have to have a theory of mind, and I have to make assumptions what you might and might not find relevant. So this is a third cognitive element that, at least in humans, in adult humans, is present and is very essential for language to work. And this whole idea that language, is just gossip, or has emerged through our urge to gossip, in a sense, is related to this idea. Okay, so now I'd like to talk about a few studies that we and other people have done with non-human primates, and you can see that our approach is quite different from what's been done in the 1950s and 60s by taking primates into the lab and trying to teach them stuff. We don't try to teach them anything. We simply observe them in their natural interactions, in their natural habitats across the world. And if possible, we try to field experiments. So we use the natural habitat as a field lab, and then try and explore what happens. And I'm going to show you a couple of examples. It's very simple stuff. It is not very sophisticated, but there is at least occasionally the option to have some control over the variables. So here are a few species that you're going to hear about today. So here are the two great apes that we work with, the chimpanzees here, and then the closely related bonobos. So maybe not everyone has a background on this stuff, but basically bonobos, they look very similar to chimpanzees, but they're not, and you only find them here in the Congo Basin, right here, this dark part of DRC, and they've been geographically isolated, most likely because of the Congo River, who splits this part of subtropical Africa, and as a result, they have evolved into their own species. They're very different in terms of their social behavior compared to the chimps, but that would be another lecture. Then there's also one or two studies on gibbons that we've looked at in Thailand. Gibbons are very interesting, obviously, because of the singing behavior. And then a bunch of old world monkeys that we've looked at, and also one species of new world monkeys, the titi monkeys. starting now with what has motivated this whole field of studying primates in the wild, this is probably the classic study that you find in almost every textbook of animal behavior and even psychology. It's the vervet monkey alarm call system, so this species has become very famous because individuals produce acoustically different alarm calls to different predators, in particular pythons, martial eagles, and leopards. And just to demonstrate this behavior, I've got three recordings. So here's a snake alarm call, then eagle, and leopard. Okay, so it might not sound very dramatically different to you, but there's been a lot of research devoted to this phenomenon, and it does turn out that by and large, these calls are very meaningful to monkeys, and the way to demonstrate that scientifically is with what's called a playback experiment. So you record the calls from a monkey who has just seen a python. You record his alarm calls, and then you wait and say, you know, a few weeks later, when the monkeys are just quietly eating or doing something else, you play that sound back to them. And the hypothesis is that if these calls convey meaning to the monkeys, they should react as if a python's around, even though, of course, there is no python around. So this is some footage that we got with the BBC when they visited our camp. And you can see here, so there's not going to be any sound, but you will be able to see quite clearly that we'll play two snake alarm calls to them. The first one wasn't super convincing, but the second one, yes. You can see they're just eating and not bothering. So here's the first one. They then ignore it. So we play another one. Right, so this is another interesting phenomenon. Either he really doesn't understand, or he's too clever and knew that. We don't know. But anyway, you saw so that's the kind of standard behavior to snakes, because snakes are typically somewhere in the high grass, and because they don't know where the snake is, they only hear the alarm call, they scan, and as they can't find the snake, they prefer to leave. Now compare that with the leopard alarm call. So the same situation again, monkeys are feeding, and now through the playback, a leopard alarm call. So you can see that the reaction is very immediate, instant, and strong, and very adaptive, because the only place you could possibly go if a leopard's here is somewhere high, somewhere up in the trees where the leopard can't get you. Okay, so here is a first hint that calls can be meaningful. So we did look at a number of other species, and I want to now talk about one species that we've done quite a bit of research on, the Campbell's monkey of Thai forest in Côte d'Ivoire. And so we looked at males and found that just at the level of the acoustic diversity, we found at least six different calls that we could discriminate. I'm just going to play them to you. Okay, so that was a non-vocal sound, so they have vocal sacs that they can inflate and make this sound. And then two basic alarm calls, the crack and the hock. Okay, so you can hear the difference relatively clearly. Okay, it's the same male. But then an interesting phenomenon for both crack and hawk, the monkey could optionally add this little suffix here. See, in both cases where the circle is, there's a little acoustic element added on to both crack and hawk, which then sounds like this. Oops, sorry. Let's just play crack again. You can't hear it that well, but you can see it in the spectrogram. So these are wild recordings, of course. It goes kahoo, right? And then hawk. Hawku. Okay, so you can hear it, right? So there's a little extra here. which does or does not have to be present. And then there's acoustic variants. So here's a waku, which sounds a bit like a hawk, but which is to complete. Okay, so you can see, so here you can hear the suffix quite well. So we were wondering what that might do. And so that's, I'm just gonna leave it like this for the moment, but just to tell you that there's this sort of suffixation phenomenon within the call. Then we looked at, we were wondering why are there so many different call types? And we looked at the sequences that these monkeys gave. So here again, you have the repertoire, the six basic calls. And then we just, so this was a PhD done by Karim Ouattara, and we just recorded, or he just recorded natural sequences that the monkeys gave during their daily paths. And he found amazing structure in it. So for example, if a monkey gave these boom calls as part of a sequence, then it was always non-predatory. So there was never a predation involved, but it could be things like large trees falling down, fighting with the neighbors, or a group travel. That's when you got the boom calls followed by, you know, this green kraku, this one, and sometimes hoku, you can see here. But so the rule here seems to have been, if it's non-predatory, then we start our sequence with a boom. Then you have here a cluster of sequences that consist of only crack and krakus, these three, and you can see here, so these are raw data really, that this is almost exclusively given in the context of leopard predation. Either they saw a real leopard, or he put out a leopard model, or he played the calls of a leopard, or he heard, or the monkeys heard the alarm calls of other monkeys to leopards. So that's what, so this seems to be a leopard signal. And then the third large context was crowned eagles. And now you can see here you never find cracks, so this call, but you do find krakus, so kraku seems to be a very general alert call, but now is where you find the hawks and the wakus and sometimes the hawkus here. So this is all crowned eagle related. So there is an interesting patterning here going on. And you can now start wondering what the rules might be to explain this system, and we haven't cracked it completely, but certainly this first one with booms present or not has caught our attention. And so here is a playback experiment that I've done a while ago, where I simply played back a series of hawks, which if you remember are eagle-related calls, or kraks, which are leopard-related alarm calls, and so from the Campbell's monkeys. But I didn't play back to the Campbell's monkeys themselves, but to another species, the dino monkey, who shares the same habitat. They often form mixed species groups and tend to live together. So the prediction was that, well, if they live together, they should understand each other. And you can see that what happens is if you play hawks, then the dino monkey here in stripe gives his own eagle alarm calls. If you play a crack, then the dino monkey gives his leopard alarm calls. So, you know, good demonstration that communication can happen between species, almost like a foreign language if you want. But now, in the key condition, we added booms in front of these hack or crack series. See here, illustrated by this red dot, and did the same thing again. And now you can see what it does, what the effects are on the dino monkey. If you do boom hawk series, no dino monkey ever gives eagle alarm calls anymore. It has completely abolished the meaning of this hawk sequence. And with the crack sequence, there were some leopard alarm calls, but significantly fewer than without the boom. So the boom seems to be modifying the meaning of these two sequences in the sense that it takes away the predation specificity that you've got in these two ones. Okay, so but there's more work needed because if you remember there are other sequences that we should look at. And so we just recently had another PhD student in Thai. So this is work, by the way, done in collaboration with Alban Lemasson from the University de Rennes. So there's Camille Coy, who looked at the crack here. So just to refresh your auditory memory here. Crack and crack-coo. Okay. So this suffixed and unsuffixed version. So this is a proper Lepid alarm, and this is the general alert that emerges from adding the suffix. And so in her experiment, what she did is she played back crack and crack-coo to Dyna monkeys, the way we've done it earlier. But now she also constructed artificial calls by, if you follow here, so here's a crack-coo. So she cut the oo bit away, which then left her with the just crack bit, okay? And then she glued the oo bit to an actual crack, which is this one. And the prediction is that if this suffix really carries any kind of meaning by making it from a leopard specific to a general to an alert call, then this manipulation should do the same trick. So monkeys should react the same to this natural call and this artificial call, and as opposed to this natural call and this artificially cut call, if you see the logic. And so she did the same thing, played it back to Dyna monkeys, and there's a whole bunch of results, and we did modeling, and overall, yes, it turned out that whether or not the suffix was present significantly explained the vocal behavior of the Dyna monkey. So there was other things that played a role, which I'm not going to go into, but the presence or absence of the suffix explained how the Dyna monkeys reacted. So here is just the males, for example. You can see natural cracks and artificial cracks for the male is exactly the same thing in terms of how his vocal response, and crack-coo, natural and artificial as well, significantly different, etc. And here's some female responses, which I don't want to discuss anymore in detail. Okay, now another monkey that we also looked at, which is also quite interesting, is the potty nose monkey in Nigeria. And here you got very similar to the Campbell's monkey. You have sequences of calls to eagles, so this would be the hawk equivalent. Or a crack equivalent, which for historical reasons are called piaos here, but it's the same basic call type. So you can see again, it's the same basic behavior that eagles and leopards trigger acoustically different calls, and these calls tend to be given in sequences. But then, in addition, this is work done with Kate Arnold. Kate found that every so often you get these sequences where both calls are produced, and first it drove us mad because it goes against any kind of theory that we knew of. We couldn't understand why suddenly the monkey would give piao hack combinations just like this one. Okay, so we didn't know what to do with that. And moreover, which was worse, sometimes there wasn't even a predator around. And the monkeys just did that. And so we looked into the data, and Kate then found that every time that these piao hack combinations were given by a male, about 15 minutes later, the group started to move. And so that we thought, well, this is quite striking. Maybe it is an initiation of group travel, and the male just combines two of his calls to make this third sequence to convey something else. So we did an experiment and elicited natural call sequences in males and simply recorded, did or did the male not give a piao hack sequence in his calls here, yes or no. And then every time we measured the distance traveled over the next hour from the group. You can see that if the male called and if there was a piao hack combination somewhere in his calls, in his call sequence, then on average the group would have traveled, around 100 meters, which is obviously quite far in a forest habitat. But if he called and did not give a Pierre Hack sequence, then they tended to stay around. So we thought, well, that's quite striking. So we did another playback experiment, so which is here on the right. So first here, what you see here is just the behavior of individual monkeys after their male has given either just piaos, just hacks, or a piao hack combination. You can see here. And here we simply measured how far would this individual travel in the next, I can't remember, 30 minutes or so, or hour. And you can see that if after a series of piaos, they tend to stay, after a series of hacks, which indicates eagle, they tend to be even less mobile. But after a series of piao hack combinations, that's where you see most movement. So in the experiment, we did exactly the same thing. We recorded natural piaos, hacks, piao hack combinations, and then we also constructed artificial piao hack combinations, hit the speaker somewhere in the vicinity, roughly from where the male was positioned, played one of these four series, and then simply measured how far would our focal animal travel in relation to the speaker. And you can see that the experimental data pretty much mirror the observational data, the only difference being that the travel distance was lower than in natural situations, which perhaps is not surprising, because I'm sure at some point they realized, well, you know, this is weird. Where is the male? I just heard the male. He's not around, etc. So that might have explained that. But the general pattern, as you see, is the same. So far we've been talking about old world monkeys who are, so the ones I've discussed are relatively closely related to each other. So there is a worry that maybe this is just kind of a specific adaptation in this group of primates, and it's perhaps not a general feature of primate cognition and communication. So to address this, we did a study in Brazil with titi monkeys. You know, it's this very tiny little New World primate that lives in monogamous family groups with a few infants. And they're very, very easy, obviously, for predators to threaten because they're small. Yet they turn out to have two alarm calls. Now, we were very, very disappointed when we heard those because they're almost nothing. So here is the first one. So this is a tiny, sounds like a dog. So that was the first call type, which if you look in the spectrogram is characterized by this little downsweep here. But then there was another one, the call B, which is the opposite, is kind of an upsweep. Okay. So this is the other alarm call that we got from this primate. So we did first do what's proper and did a playback. We played either call A in black or call B in gray, two different monkeys, and simply measure what do they do. And you can see there was three types of reactions. Either they would look up towards the sky, they would look down onto the ground, or towards the caller. There was these three basic gazing reactions. And now you can see that if you play in call A, then the most obvious reaction is that they look up. They rarely look down and they rarely look to the caller. So we concluded that call A most likely is an aerial predator alarm. Call B was the opposite. They rarely looked up, they sometimes looked down, and they typically first looked at the caller as if to get additional information. But then, two basic call types with two functions, no doubt. But then again, we noticed that they never just give one call, but sometimes a whole series of calls. And so we thought, well, we would like to know in more detail what these series and sequences look like. And so so this is also work by a PhD student, Chris Caesar. And she argued that, well, maybe what matters for these monkeys is also where the predator is, not just what type it is. So she used two basic predator types, this cat here, and then a typical raptor, Caracara, and she, both were models that she used. So here's her model, and up here is the real thing, just to show you that the models were, you know, pretty good. So so these were just stuffed animals from a natural history museum. And then she positioned these models either on the ground or in the trees. So the cat could be on the ground or in the trees, and so could the raptor. And then she recorded the monkeys' reactions, and these are raw data. So each line is one group, starting with group A, D, etc. And now you can see what she got. So if she puts the raptor in the canopy, she gets straight A reactions. O means she couldn't determine what it was, but everyone just answers with A. If she puts the raptor on the ground, she gets a mix. So most or all of them start with A, but then you can see there were some groups who sooner or later started giving Bs as well. So it's as if the fact that the raptor was on the ground was an additional variable that was encoded in their vocal behavior. Then cat on the ground, as you can see, straight B, so that's kind of what we expected. But then again, cat in the canopy, very interesting. All five groups started with an A call and then switched to B, and this one was a bit more mixed, but again, you get a mix of calls. So in theory, it is possible that these monkeys not just encode the predator type, but by combining calls, also express something about the location of these predators. So we're working on this now with another doctoral student who is doing experiments along these lines, and we'll see what the answer is. We don't know yet. Okay, so now going to the great apes, because of course this is our crown species. If you do want to make arguments about language evolution, then in some sense you have to have evidence from chimps or bonobos as our closest relatives, because if you do find, you know, these sorts of phenomena in very distantly related species, but not in apes, then it's simply convergent evolution, which is interesting, but not so interesting for us. So the question here was, is there any evidence for any kind of sequential communication in great apes? And so here is a study done by Zana Clay. Now this is done at the zoo, so this is one of the few zoo studies we've done, Twycross in England. And so Zana noticed that the bonobos at the zoo, they like kiwi and they don't like apple. So, but they would give calls to both fruits, and what was striking was that there wasn't really any clear order. So you can see now there is, she found at least four different call types that these bonobos can give to food. So here is, for example, a bark, another bark, a peep and a bark, and then this animal does a peep, yelp, a peep, a peep, a peep, and then here again, peep, 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 yelp, yelp. And then to apple, you have some other sequences, but basically it's kind of a mix. And so I just want to play this quickly. So this is just put these four calls together to give you a sense. Okay, so that would have been a reaction to kiwi. Now here the same animal's reaction to apple. Okay, so it's quite confusing, you know, different calls, but given in sequences. So we did analyze all this, and it did turn out that barks were more common to kiwi than to apple, and yelps were more common to apple than to kiwi. So there was some kind of stochastic patterns in there, but at the level of the individual calls, you couldn't really say anything, because you can see now, you know, barks can be given here or here, so you can't listen to a single call and know what the monkey has found, I mean the ape has found. So we thought, well, let's see, and did a playback experiment. And so what we did here on the left, we established two feeding locations, an apple site and a kiwi site here on the right. So the apes learned that very quickly, that on the right is kiwi and the left is apple. And then we played, when they were all inside, from the middle, we played either a sequence originally given to apple or to kiwi. So we played about four or five calls in a sequence, either to apple or to kiwi, and then we simply watched where would they devote most of their foraging efforts to. So in the experiment, there wasn't any food. They just came out, they heard the calls, started searching, and couldn't find anything because there was, we wanted to measure what they did. And you can see now, if you play them a kiwi sequence, there's much more search effort devoted to the kiwi site than to the apple site. And then apple, which they like less, overall less search effort, but again, significantly more to the apple site than to the kiwi site. So in conclusion, yes, they must be able to extract something from these sequences, even though at the level of the individual calls, they can't really learn anything. They have to listen to the whole sequence and then make up their minds. So just something on the side here. Just going back to the thing, you can see now there's this peep call here. Well, it turns out that the peep call is not specific to food. They peep to almost anything. You know, when they travel, when they see a fight, when they, all kinds of reasons. We're wondering if, you know, why would that be? Why do you have a call that is given in such a broad context? And I think this kind of leads to a new area of research which is underexplored. And here just to the phenomenon here. So here is a peep to travel, resting. Here is a peep to agonistic fights, to alarm. And here is a peep to feed from four different animals. And you can see they're acoustically, I mean, they're indistinguishable, more or less. It's just these kind of bands, where it's very simple call, bands of energy. So we did do acoustic analysis, and the alarm peeps, we could identify as an acoustically distinct calls, but all the others were just indistinguishable. So in other words, for these calls to have any kind of communicative function, it must be, it must be interpreted in relation to the ongoing context, to the pragmatics, if you want, of the situation. So just to let you know, not every primate call is very specific to one type of event. Some calls are very general, and then other processes might happen. To kind of end this section on combinatorial signals, a study on gibbons. So gibbons, as you all know, they sing. You know, they have these very elaborate songs. And so here are a few song units that you can identify. But they also sing to predators, astonishingly. So here is just to give you an idea, a duet song, that this is normal, non-predatory behavior, two individuals singing together. Okay, so what you can see, it's highly coordinated, and on the top left, it's a depiction of the different song units that they give. Okay, so so you can see it's highly diverse. They go through the repertoire at ease. Now, if you show them a predator model, they also sing to the predator. But now here, the structure is different. What you'll see is it's much more stereotyped. So the basic thing that you can extract so far is that once they choose a song note, a song unit, they tend to repeat it. So it's much more stereotyped, but it's exactly the same song units that you also find in duet songs. So they make differential use of the song repertoire depending on whether or not it's just a normal duet song in the morning or if it's in relation to an external stimulus. And here again, we're working on this with playbacks, and we can already tell you the other gibbons listening to these two song types can easily distinguish the two. They know exactly whether or not the singer has seen a predator or not. So this is conveying information. Okay, so for the rest of the time, I want to move on to the two other elements of the language faculty, if you want, that I find essential. The first one is this idea that a signal has to be intentional. You know, you want to do something with your recipient. You want to change his behavior, his mind, whatever. And then thirdly, this idea of being cooperative. So just quickly, there is most of the evidence of intentional communication so far has come from gesture studies. So there's been a lot of gesture studies done in captivity where the argument has been that gestures are being used to somehow interact with the recipient, but I want to show you a few studies of vocal behavior too. Here's just the chimpanzee study in Budongo Forest. Okay, so this is just really to get you into the spirit, because that's what we see and what they see, which is pretty much nothing. So a lot of the social interactions that happen in the wild, you just cannot see because the visibility is so poor. And therefore, the vocalizations play an extremely important role, because they're almost like readouts of what the animal is going through, which then other animals can attend to and benefit from. And what you've heard and seen now is a fight between two animals, the first one being the victim who ran away, but then he somehow got support from another animal, became more confident, and then came back and retaliated. And as he did so, his vocalizations changed. So I can now listen to this guy and know that, okay, he must have found someone to help him because his calls changed. So it's very honest signaling as a reflection of what goes on. Then within the victim screams, you can also tell quite clearly how bad the aggression was. So here are three spectrograms of screams given by victims. And we did acoustic analysis, and you can correlate the acoustic structure with four basic types of aggression. Very mild, where the opponent was just kind of, you know, doing a display or walking in some provocative way. But no chase involved. Up to here, where the individual is being singled out and chased. And finally, actually physical abuse, where the victim is being grabbed and beaten and slapped, etc. So all this you can get from the vocalizations, more or less. And the other thing is that there's also an interesting audience effect. So if a victim is being attacked by an aggressor here, and there is no real powerful audience nearby, so for example, only some young animals who can't help, then his screams are acoustically different compared to when there is a powerful audience nearby, such as the alpha male. And just so that's a victim scream who's being attacked. Now the same victim, the same animal being attacked, but with a powerful audience nearby. So it has an additional influence on the acoustic structure, and what's interesting is that the acoustic structure of the victim screams, they degrade towards the more severe end with a powerful audience nearby, even though the exact same thing happens to the victim. So it's as if they're trying to influence the audience to you know, come and help them, which they sometimes do. So it is, in a sense, a little bit of deceptive, and they're trying to persuade. So these screams function to recruit others to come and help them. And if they think there is a big chance to persuade someone, then they'll exaggerate, if you want. Okay, so I mentioned gesturing as the kind of king's way of intentional communication. And I agree, it is very, very obvious to see how, you know, you can see intentionality most clearly in gestures. Here a little study we've done at the Lola Ya Bonobo Sanctuary in the Congo with bonobos. Now this is about sex, where we've seen that a lot of individuals have this kind of beckoning gesture, so they, you know, they're trying to interact with each other sexually, but ideally not right here in the group. They're somewhat trying to lure the other away, and they use this sort of beckoning gesture, similar to humans. So if you watch this guy here, you can see what I mean. sorry, not this one over there. So here he is. So he's gonna. So he's done his beckoning thing. The target animal is down here. You're going to see her in a second. He wants to have sex with her. She's not convinced yet. So he comes back, and you can just see how goal-oriented he is and what he's trying to convey with his, you know, with his arm. So that's just to set the context right. Now another beckoning. He leads the way. Another beckoning, and now she finally gives in, he beckons again. So he used his gestures to, in a sense, change the behavior of this target animal in his favor, and here it worked. You also see that in other animals, so here's a young male who's trying to do the same, but of course no one listens to him. So that's in slow motion, but you can see it's the same arm movement to try and lure someone away from the group. Okay, so we did analyze this in a bit more detail, but this is just to show you the basic phenomenon. So another thing with intentions is that it's not just you who has an intention, and I think I've convinced you that you can see these intentions in both vocal behavior and gestures. But the point is also that you must be able to understand the intention of the other, you know, to be functioning well in these societies. And here a little study we've done with the chimpanzees in Budongo Forest. And we did notice that, so during aggression there's all kinds of stuff happening and a lot of vocal behavior as we've just seen. But there's also stuff happening later on. And so here, what we did is we waited for a natural aggressive event to happen. So A is the aggressor, V is the victim. And then we followed the victim for about 2 hours. The aggressor was gone. And then 2 hours later, we played from a speaker the aggressive barks from an ally, a friend of the former aggressor, or someone else, okay? And because these chimps, you know, form alliances with each other and help each other, we predicted that if, you know, if the victim understood that, you know, because there has been an aggression towards him, that his friends may still be angry at him and have bad intentions at him, then he should react more strongly to an ally than a non-ally. So here's just a call that we played. Okay, this is a threatening call from a chimpanzee. You know that if you're a chimp. But what matters is that who is the one who gives these calls. And so here we compared ally and non-ally after 2 hours after aggression, and you can see the reaction was very, very different. If it was a non-ally, they don't care, they just keep on feeding, whatever. If it's an ally, they look towards the speaker, are quite worried, and you can see, you know, 30 seconds of looking, so they're really, you know, wondering what's going on. And also in terms of locomotion behavior, if you play them a non-ally, they can even approach the speaker sometimes, they want to know what's going on, or they just stay neutral. But if it's an ally, then they move away. So they clearly know something about the behavior of others, the likely behaviors of others that happen, even if it's 2 hours after the key event. So there's more studies on this, but just to kind of give you a flavor of what goes on. So in the final section, which I find the most difficult one to work with, is this idea that human language is highly cooperative. We want to be informative. We have what's in German called the Mitteilungsbedürfnis. We really want to be meaningful to the other. We want to say stuff that's relevant for the other. The question is, do we see this kind of level of helpfulness in primate communication or not? I think the answer is so far probably not, but there are a few, well, it's just two or three studies I want to quickly discuss that indicate that there is at least some kind of connection going on between primate signalers and the recipients. This is a study, again, with the bonobos in Lola, a gesturing study, where we interacted with them as human beings. And what they do is, during feeding time, they come to the fence, as you can see, and they usually have one caretaker who gives them food. And each bonobo has a repertoire of gestures to try and get the food. And some gestures are general, like just simple begging, you know, you hold out your hand. But then some animals have developed idiosyncratic personal gestures, which they only seem to use with this particular caretaker. So here's a female trying to get food. So you can see it works. So she has developed this signal specifically for this caretaker to somehow convince him to give the food to her and not to all the others. So that's the basic phenomenon. So we thought, well, this is interesting. And the prediction is, well, if they really understand that this signal is sort of between me and you, you know, because you're my caretaker and I know that, you know, you understand me, then she should not use this signal to just anyone who doesn't know her. So we did an experiment by showing up with a familiar caretaker and an unfamiliar caretaker who then did all kinds of things. And so in the first analysis, this is simply just to show you that they do pay attention about what the other does. So the caretaker could be either attentive, left, or inattentive, right. And so inattentive just being, you know, looking around and not paying attention. And then we simply counted how many silent signals or how many audible signals did these different individuals produce. And each line is one individual. And you can see that if they're attentive, they're much more likely to give silent signals than if they're inattentive, they're much likely to give audible signals. So they understand something about the attentional state of their recipient. But this has already been known, so this is just a replication. But what's more interesting here is familiar caretaker left and unfamiliar. And here we simply looked at the sequences of gestures that these bonobos gave. And you can see that, so here they're trying to convince the caretaker to give him some food. And you can see that if with the familiar guy, if they're not successful, they tend to repeat the same gesture again. It's like, you know, you understand me, so just, you know, do what you're supposed to do. So they kind of say the same thing again. However, if it's a non-familiar one and they're not successful, then they're much more likely to change the gesture and try another one. So this is at least consistent with the idea that they somehow can discriminate between recipients who are where they have a shared convention with and others where they don't, because there's no point in repeating a gesture to someone who doesn't understand what it means. So some, you know, weak evidence that they can take the other's knowledge, if you want, into account. Okay, now to finish off, just two playback studies that we've done with the chimpanzees again in Bodongo Forest. So this is now natural. Situation where we do think there is some indication that they actively inform each other about stuff that's relevant for others. The first one has to do with food. So if they find food, they tend to produce specific vocalizations, these food grunts, which indicate I have found food. And so first, we found that if they travel with friends, So they never just travel in the whole group, all 70 together. They tend to form little parties of, you know, 5, 6, 10 animals. If they travel with a party of friends, they're much more likely to give these food calls here on the right than if they travel with individuals they're not really friendly with. So that's already interesting. And then we did a playback study. So we waited until our focal animal was up in a tree, on a fig tree feeding, and then we played from a speaker the calls of a friend or a non-friend to simulate his arrival. Okay, so the animal's up there, we play the call from a speaker, and now we want to know what does the guy up there in the tree say. And you can see now what mattered was two things. It was the rank difference. So if we simulated the arrival of a very high-ranking animal, then he was much more likely to call than not to call. But equally important was the friendship. So if we simulated the arrival of a friend, he was also more likely to call than not to call. So friendship and high rank both drove call rates up. Now keep in mind, this guy is already eating up there. He already knows there's food. He's already had his fix and all that. And still he starts calling again if the right individual arrives. Okay, now the final study, before we end here, is again about predation. So in these forests in Uganda where we work, there are hardly any more leopards because they've all been shot. But there are snakes, quite a lot. And what you see here is a gaboon viper. I'm just going to show you where she is. There. So very extremely well hidden, camouflaged. So here is the head. And then here's the whole body. So you can barely see these animals. It's incredible. But she's right there, fully exposed. And the chimps are terrified when they find one. Presumably they have had some bad experiences, especially at night. They can strike, and that's usually deadly. So we benefited from that by doing a simple field experiment. So what we did is we made a model of a snake and positioned it on the side of the path, and then let our subjects discover these snakes naturally. And what we were really interested in was how do these animals behave towards the snake and towards other animals who arrive later. Because you're going to have a situation now like here where the guy comes, sees the snakes, he's alone for a moment. So he could just start screaming, of course, or he could wait and deliver his screams when it's really important for the audience. And that's exactly what they do. So here's see what he does. He's seeing the snake. Now, see, he doesn't really say much, even though he's clearly startled. He gives these soft cues. And then, at some point, he's going to realize that his friend arrives from behind. And as soon as he notices the arrival of his friend, that's when he gives his call.
He's here with Nick and Salou.
Turn around. See? Now he's giving his call because, as you'll see, he's just noticed that he's fine too. There he is. And he understands, or at least understands something, because he doesn't perceive. He sits down, waits, and probably checks who else is following from behind. So if you want, there is clearly this sort of sense of trying to inform each other. And clearly he had no idea, he didn't know there was a snake, so this, is relevant information for him. So we did a rough analysis here and just checked for cases where the receiver was completely ignorant, just like the way you've seen, which makes calling much more likely, or where the receiver already knows about the snake, and then you see then calling is much less likely, interestingly. So callers are much more motivated to call if their audience is ignorant than if it's knowledgeable about these events. But, I mean, this is really, quite a rough experiment, so this needs to be done more properly, because it's quite an important question, of course. Okay, so this is really it. So just a quick summary. So, again, you have sort of a phylogenetic tree with humans and the great chimps and bonobos as the three most closely related apes with a common ancestry around sort of 6 to 10 million years. So what we can say is that, yes, humans are the only ones with speech. There's no question. I think we can safely conclude that. Apes can't speak. They don't have the vocal control needed to produce all these signals. But to me, that's not the key question. It's more to do with the underlying cognitive abilities that you need to have in place, which is the, you know, the ability to extract meaning from these arbitrary sounds, to be intentional in the sense that you got your audience in your mind, and also to be cooperative, to say stuff that's meaningful to the other. And as hopefully you've seen, that there is pockets of evidence that suggest that some of these capacities are in place in these apes, maybe not as fully developed as in ours, especially not in terms of taking the other's knowledge into account, etc. But you know, we do see traces of that. And I think when it comes to extracting meaning from sound, that seems to be a very general a capacity that is much, much older. And surely, you know, those of you who own a dog know exactly that your dog understands much more than you would think, because it can, you know, maybe understand the relation between certain sounds and certain events, etc. So this seems to be much more ancestral. Yeah, that's it. So thanks very much, and I'm glad to take questions.